show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Bouncing ball, Moustakas, fair ball. Sets, throws, Royals win it. Kansas City, you've got a World Series.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, ladies and gentlemen. We have a big show for you today. Not really, but it's big of importance. Not necessarily in time, necessarily. Although, who knows at this point.
You probably said that before, too. So.
Yes. But big because we are officially at the, obviously, the midway point of a 162-game season is 81 games. But the unofficial slash kind of also official midway point is the All-Star break. And we're finally here. All this talk about All-Stars and voting and who's going to make the team. And we're finally here. But we're going to get to that in a second. Of course, the introductions, as always, I am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me, the indubitable Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this fantastic Sunday afternoon when we're recording this?
I'm inside in an air-conditioned apartment, so I'm good.
Good, yeah. The room that I have, that's kind of like our office room, is... we basically only use it for when I record and when I do like my nerdy things like drawing and stuff. So we turn off close the vent in there. So every time I come in here, it's just hot. And this is the first time that it's been like really hot. So I had to open the vent. So hopefully it'll be cool enough for me to make it through this show. But if you hear a big thud, it's probably
you've
me
passed
from
out.
Heat stroke, call the ambulance, please.
Right. And if you're hearing this tomorrow and hear this, well, still call the ambulance, I guess.
Yeah, just to be sure.
Probably
so, big happenings we got going on. There was the final count of All-Stars now from the Royals.
Yeah.
Seven now, because Mike Moustakas did represent with 19.3 million votes, and Mike Moustakas was the seventh All-Star, shattering the previous Royals record of 5 All-Stars in one season.
Yeah.
Now with 7, if you can believe that. So here we are. And with all those All-Stars playing, of course, Gordon, because of his injury, won't be playing. So there'll only be 6 there, but 7 elected to the game. And if you want to watch all of those Royals play, minus Gordon, of course, and why wouldn't you?
Of course.
Then the most perfectest venue to do such a thing is Kelly's Westport Inn on Tuesday night, starting at 6. Mike will be there. I will be there. This show will be there. We'll be doing a live show. We're going to have a bunch of people there, hopefully a big turnout. The fake Ned will be there. Chris Kamler, obviously. If that deters you, then just forget we made that up. Yep, he won't actually be there. Or we'll just put him in the corner for a little while. Who knows? We're going to have, hopefully a lot of the Royals blogger crowd, a lot of confirmations that have come in. So it's going to be a good – lot of good Royals, a lot of good baseball discussion, and beers, which are always fun. So come on over to Kelly's Tuesday night starting at 6. We're all going to be there. We're all going to be having a great time. We're going to watch some Royals kick ass in the All-Star game because that's what they're going to do. So that'll be fun. So now that we get that out of the way – we can talk about, as I said, we're recording this on Sunday, shortly after the Royals just pulled out a royal coaster of a win against the Blue Jays. My word. You can see why the Blue Jays have such a ridiculously high run differential, but continue to hover at or below 500 in terms of record, because they can score runs quickly and in bunches, and they can give them up just the same.
Yeah.
Before you even blinked in the first inning, it was 6-0, and the Royals extended that to a 7-0 lead, and you thought it was in the bag. Sixth inning, Edinson Volquez had been cruising, up 7-0, boom. This is in the bag with the Royals bullpen, right?
Should be, yeah.
Wrong. Wrong.
Yeah.
Volquez gives up 2 runs, and they pull in Madsen comes in to relieve him, and they think, oh, you think, okay, all right, gave up two runs, still a good start, bullpen will clean this up. No. Yeah. They end up...
They boot a double play ball, like perfect double play ball.
Oh, man, perfect. Escobar booted it and then still recovered that they could have gotten at least one out, and then Infante biffed it. So that was just an ugly, ugly play, and that kind of set it off. And sometimes when those things happen, they, as anybody who watched the 05 or 06 era Royals knows, when those things happen, they just compound on each other and just gets bad. So then next thing you know, it's 8-7 Blue Jays, and it's, oh, crap, we're in for a game. And then the Royals come back, and they make it 10-8. And then the Blue Jays come back, and they tie it up. And then finally the Royals score a run in that inning, the bottom of that very same inning, and end up taking it 11-10, where using Kelvin Herrera, Wade Davis, and Greg Holland all in the same game. Did Herrera come in? I was traveling.
Herrera came in to replace Madsen after Madsen got pulled.
I was at my a family thing, and then I had traveled from there to home, so I missed a little bit of stuff. So I thought he'd come in, but anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, but anyway, at least they got the All-Star break for using that much of the bullpen to rest, although two of those key members won't get too much of a rest because they'll be at the game.
They're going
although
to Cincinnati.
Who knows if they pitch, but they'll be there. So the culmination of that victory means that the Royals are 52-34.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? 52-34, 18 games over 500. I'd have to go back and look at the game log last year. I don't remember a single time that they were actually 18 games over. Were they 18 games over at any point last year?
I mean, they won 89 to finish the year, which was 16 over.
I was gonna say, yeah, they finished 16.
And I know they won the last game, so they would have been 15 over going into that. So it's not like they fell back or anything. So I don't think so. I don't think they ever reached 18 games over at any point last year.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Even in, like, August, they were only – I don't even – they were – when they took first place that Sungwoo game, they were 64-53. So even then, taking first place at that point was, you know, only 11 games. And they had to, like, march all the way back just to get to there. So – I don't think so. I think 16 was probably their high mark last year.
Yeah, they were up. They were 78-62 at one point when they were up a game and a half. Mm. 79-63. And then, yep, 89-73 to finish it out. So, yeah. So they're better than they were at any point. Right now, they're record-wise better than they were at any point last season, which is incredibly impressive. And, I mean... It's been one hell of a ride so far for this first half of the season. Almost exactly. The Royals have missed a few games because of inclement weather. So they're, you know, at 86 games, they're closer to being exactly halfway than the majority of the teams in the league.
Yeah.
Who have played closer to 90 games at this point. But as you remember, if you've been listening to this show, that Mike and I had a few bold predictions at the beginning of the season. Mike, throw it down for me.
All right.
Let's start one apiece. Give me my...
Okay.
We'll start with me, and then we'll go to you. Go with my, my first bold prediction. What did I make?
The first one, and this was from April 2nd, so this was just before the season started. This is about 4 days before opening day. Your first bold prediction was that the Royals would eclipse 2 million in attendance for the 2015 season.
2 million.
Two million.
That's a lot.
That's a lot, and it's only something that's happened a few times in franchise history. I mean, the K isn't the biggest stadium, and there was that really lean period from 04 until basically 2013 where there was never a winner. 2011 was pretty decent because you had all the prospects, but
right.
Yeah, the Royals this year, they after today's game, they're officially at over 1.5 million in attendance this season. So that's in 46 home games. So it's about 32,000 per game, which is the highest average per game in franchise history by about 2,000 people. they're on pace for almost 2.7 million in attendance, which is would be obviously a franchise record. The franchise record is 2.47, which was in 1989. So
2.7 million. That's
yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean,
you never would have thought. Like,
what would they have to do? Even if they only got 20,000 the remainder of their home schedule, they're still over 2 million.
And there's just no way that that'll happen.
Right. Not the way that they're at. I mean, it's just, it's going to be, they're going to easily set the record this year. Unless they just absolutely tank and lose like 20 in a row, which I don't even know if that would do it. They'd still only be two games under if that happened. So, I mean,
that's a good point.
They're still in the running, considering, you know, how Detroit's played and how, you know, people probably expect Minnesota to play. So,
yeah, I mean, they're 4.5 up on Minnesota, and Minnesota's having a pretty darn good season.
Yeah, Minnesota's having a really good year. I just don't think anybody believes in it. Like, I don't even think Minnesota believes in it. But
no.
I mean, stranger things have happened. But I mean,
they believe in it, and we've made this comparison before. But I feel like they believe in it as much as we believe in that we believed in the 2003 Royals. See what I did there? See what I did?
Yeah,
that?
Yeah.
We
believe.
Yes, nosotros creemos. So yeah, there's, it's just, I mean, I'm almost speechless. Like you, it's, you know, this is the, this will be, you know, if things hold serve, if you will, mm-hmm. you know, that unless the Royals tank it big time in the second half, this will be the third consecutive winning season, which has never happened in my lifetime. And it will be the, I mean, it's just, it should feel at least a little bit normal by now, but I think the Royals were just so, it's not as though they were just kind of bad. Like the mm-hmm. Rangers, you know, when they, you know, a few years ago when they had their really good, that really good 4 or 5 year run before they kind of had to retool a little bit this, even though they're doing pretty well this year, but even them, you know, beforehand, they were never terrible. You know, they had some bad teams, but they were exciting. They were fun. They, you know, they were never terrible. The Royals teams were just so bad. And I think that's why, for me, it's just so hard to really grasp this. But it's for real. It's not going anywhere, and I'm loving it.
Yeah, it's, you know, even in, like, 2013, they were in it, but they weren't really. They were always. They needed so much help towards the end of the year that it just wasn't enough. I mean, that May of that year really buried them, and they were always behind it. But they still finished with the winning record. They were still kind of in the mix even down to the last week. And that carried over into 2014. 2014, you see, you know, last year James Shields and the Royals end up having that big push in June and July, and then take it all the way to the end and end up 90 feet away from tying the World Series. And then this year they just jumped right out 7-0, and they've just played good baseball since. I mean, it's, you know, there's nothing really flashy. It's not like anybody's having like a collectively huge year that, you know, you expect it to cool down or anything. It's not
right.
Like some guy jumped out and has hit 25 homers and, you know, hitting 390 and things like that. It's like, you know, it's there are some holes in this team. There are some weak starting pitchers. There are some, you know, were some warning signs from some guys in the bullpen. And it's like they're not perfect, but they're playing really well. They have, you know, best record in the AL, first team to 50 wins. Just it's a weird place to be because you almost feel really almost comfortable. And I'm not used to that. I'm used to I'm not used to watching teams to extend a lead. I'm so used to watching and hoping that my team can catch another team that it's a weird transition as a fan to just watch it and let it develop and really not. It's just, I don't know. It's just very bizarre to me.
And somebody made a tweet the other day that they had when the Royals were playing the Rays, and they happened to be watching the Rays broadcast, not sure why or how, but and they said that you can really sense from the Rays broadcasters the frustration in that team's face when playing the Royals. And then I saw somebody with a similar post later that showed that I had like a screenshot of the division, and everybody was on. And everybody had either won that day or was on like a two-game or more winning streak or something. and they're, God, I cannot remember who it was. Maybe it was Hunter Samuel. Maybe it might have. I don't know. But it was the comment was just that the Royals are now officially that team that's so annoying because they just won't lose. And it's totally true. That's the team. And that's, you know, I was thinking about this today, and it's a testament to how well Dayton Moore has built this team. And I can't even believe those words as they come out of my mouth, because I in particular have maligned him so much on this show.
Yeah.
But it's, I think part of that was when you go back and look, you know, like we've talked so much about the Royals and their identity that they have this year and how clear it is and how much everyone on the team buys into it. And that's part of what has made them so successful. But you really saw the growing pains of that in trying to, like, this wasn't something where, you know, Dayton Moore had a clear vision of what he wanted when he came. I think he thought he did, but it didn't necessarily, you know, everything didn't go to plan, obviously,
right,
for his first few years. And so, you know, you saw it with, was it after the 2011 season or 2012, where I think it was 2011 season, maybe. I can't remember, where Ned Yost was, you know, so-and-so can hit 25 home runs, and Butler can hit 25 home runs, and Perez can hit 25,
yeah, and Haas can hit 30,
and Kane can hit 20 home runs, and all this. And it was like, you got the sense, and then they fired the hitting coach, and they were like, we want to hit, they fired Seitzer, and they're like, we want to hit more home runs. That's what we want to do. We're going to walk and hit home runs. And, you know, they'd spent all this time in the minors emphasizing contact, and they get to the majors and they're like, we want to hit home runs. And there was all these conflicts and everything. It just, they didn't quite know. They thought they knew what they wanted, and then they would just kind of change it on the fly. And it just, it became a mess, and you could see it that they had the talent, but it just wasn't coming together.
Yeah. And it's like they didn't recognize some of the, I guess, weaknesses of some of the guys. Like, I mean, you can look at Hosmer and be like, clearly that's a guy who, if he puts it together, is an all-star guy.
Yes. You know,
Moustakas is an all-star. I mean, not having a great season, but he's having a very good season. And he started out with a very good, you know, a really good season too. So it's like you can kind of recognize that, yeah, the talent is there, but it's how do you use it. And, you know, guy, if Hosmer's overdoing it to try to hit homers, then, you know, maybe you do need to make a change in his approach. Moustakas made that change, and now he's seeing benefits from those adjustments. And the Royals kind of had to figure that out, too, it seems like, that they had to recognize what they did have, but also recognize what they maybe didn't have, and not try to be that. And so now you've got a lineup that's top to bottom pretty well balanced, you know, at least in the top like seven. You've got some guys with some power, you have some guys who make a lot of contact and get it in play, you got some good overall team speed and base running, and then you just kind of hope you get something out of Infante and Rios towards the bottom, and you know, or Dyson if he's batting ninth or something. And it kind of works, because you've got at any time a guy who can put the ball in play, a lot of guys who can hit it hard. And that, the last 2 years have really shown, or the last year and a half have really shown that, you know, you can kind of get there. As long as you've got the defense and everything behind you, you kind of know that all you need to do is get that fourth run, that fifth run, and be able to get it to the sixth inning. And you're pretty much good there. You know, you can pretty much ice it from that point. So I think once they kind of recognize that, they kind of fed off of that, and you know, everybody's bought into it. It's definitely an identity that they know exactly who they are. They know what their game is, and they go out and do it. And it's paying dividends and paying off right now.
Yeah, it's really been quite impressive to see that evolution. And it, you know, the, like you said, last year they've kind of proven that not only the Royals, but, you know, the Cardinals last year, they were near the bottom of the league in the National League for hitting home runs and everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in term, you don't have to be
and
a
the
mashing.
Giants usually are too.
Yeah, the Giants, exactly. And you don't have to be a mashing team to win anymore. You know, that might have been late 90s, early 2000s mantra, but the Royals have proven in this kind of, as we've talked about before, this kind of reverse money ball thing where, you know, they emphasize contact, and it's so apparent with the Royals having such good defense, you know, because what it does, what the Royals do so well is, you know, we've heard it, they're always near the bottom of the league in walks, but in the last few years they've started to be near the bottom of the league in strikeouts, and meaning mm-hmm. the least amount of strikeouts. They're one of the hardest teams to strike out in the league. And it's because they're so good at making contact. When you put the ball in play that much, enough of the time, things are going to happen. And that's what the Royals do. They expose teams, because when you have a bad team like – or not a bad team, but say an overachieving team like the Twins, right? And they had that four-game series against the Twins a little while ago. They just smoked mm-hmm. them. Or, you know, a team like the Brewers or something where they just tore them apart. It's that similar kind of deal where they're – Even if they're like the Twins and they're playing above their heads, you know, you can expose those weaknesses by putting the ball in play enough. Mm-hmm. And the Royals are just excellent at doing that. And on the flip side, when teams do that to them, their defense is so good that there's nothing to expose. So they can counteract that. Because the biggest variable in baseball, as we know, is luck or chance or randomness or whatever you want to call it. And nobody knows how to control it. But, you know, when you put the ball in play, you're giving yourself more opportunity for it to fall in your favor. And that's what the Royals have been doing. And it's been working out for them. And their defense is so good that teams can't do it against them. So when they've effectively tipped the scales in their direction. It's incredible.
It's constant pressure, and you're forcing the other team to make that play, whereas the Royals feel comfortable if they're forced to make that play.
Yes.
And so it's like you get it on both ends of it. So it really works out for them that, you know, they're going to make those plays, and they don't care if you put it in play. Like, go for it, but they're going to make you make it. And you saw it today, like a couple of the plays against the Blue Jays, Reyes made a mistake, a couple of mistakes on different balls. You know, they put it in play, and Colabello and left made a mistake and didn't play it right. And so they kind of benefited from a lot of those different things because the Blue Jays aren't as good of a defensive team. And when you look at the entire division, all four teams trailing the Royals are negative on defensive runs saved. And the Royals have, you know, 4.5 game lead on a team that nobody believes in. So, I mean, it's a good blueprint for them. So I think that totally works in their favor, and they know what they are. They know, you know, let's just buckle it down, get our outs, and go for it. And as I say that, they just I'm watching the replay of this game from today for some reason, because I'm a masochist, I guess. And they're in the sixth inning, and they just showed the botched double play. So that's fun.
That happens.
Yeah.
But And I think not only is it the identity, but like you just mentioned, just to kind of latch on to one of the words you said of comfort. You know, they're comfortable in that identity. You know, because it's like step one, find out what your team's identity needs to be, and then step two, everyone needs to get comfortable with that. And now that they are, it's like you said, it's an intense pressure on the other team always. And it makes me think of tennis. I always thought it was weird when, you know, I don't watch a ton of tennis, but I know they have statistics for forced errors and unforced errors, you know? Uh-huh. So, you know, unforced error would be, I don't know, whatever somebody hits the ball and hits into the net and it's not the other person didn't do it, you know, whatever. But it's kind of that the Royals have a lot of forced errors on the other team because they're aggressive on the base paths. And so players know, okay, here's a base hit into left center field. I gotta scoop this grounder and get it up quick, because they're going to be charging around first, ready to go to second if I don't get it in fast enough. Mm-hmm. And then maybe he bobbles the ball. Maybe they miss it when they try and glove it and everything. And same deal with, you know, turning a double play. You know, a lot of the majority of the players I have a lot of fast players on the Royals that, you know, mm-hmm. if Lorenzo Cain hits a deep ball into the deep shortstop and he's got to make a play on it and he goes to second, that turn from second to first, that's in the back of their head. I got to make this super quick and precise because Cain is so fast, he's going to get there. And that gets in their heads. And those errors are forced. And that is another area that that's something that the Royals can control. It seems this kind of nebulous area. It's hard to quantify in terms of statistical analysis, but it's there and everyone knows it's there. And you can hear it when they interview players and when they interview managers from opposing teams and how they talk about the Royals. They're constantly in these teams' heads.
Yeah, and it's got to get frustrating. I mean, I just remember like the ALCS last year when the Orioles would hit the ball and their fans were saying, you know, why even bother hitting it to the outfield?
Yeah.
They're just going to get it. And that's pretty much what Lorenzo Cain did. He just, anything hit his way, he caught it. Mm-hmm. And I figure, these guys are human. You have to figure at some point, what's it going to take to get a ball to drop? And if you just keep doing that, well, then, you know, do you swing? Do you change your approach to try to not hit it there? I mean, once you start tinkering there, I don't know if you're out of your game already. So I think that really works in their favor.
Yeah. And I mean, I think if you look at like the ALDS when they were playing the Angels, you know, I think if I remember correctly, I think Mike Trout got robbed a couple times early on.
Yeah.
In the series, and he ended up having a pretty poor series offensively.
Yeah, he got one hit.
And one hit.
They were already down like 5-0 when he hit. No, I think that was the first inning. So he had a home run second at bat of that game. But
yeah,
still, it was the only hit of the series. So
yeah, and then they came right back in the bottom of that inning and tied it up or the next inning or whatever it was.
They chased C.J. Wilson out. So
yeah, so, you know, it was in his head because he's kind of like, what, you know, I'm the best player on the planet. What the hell do I have to do
to
hit against this defense?
Fast Lorenzo.
And I honestly think that had a big impact on why he didn't perform as well. So that's interesting. But we spent too much time shooting off the hip from that topic.
Completely on a tangent.
Yes, that never happens on this show, though.
Right.
Give it to me, Mike. What was your first bold prediction?
My first bold prediction was that by the end of the year, Christian Colon would be the starting second baseman, which to this point is not the case. Colon obviously has been optioned to AAA basically to give him a chance to actually play every day. He was doing okay. I mean, not great, you know, 244 average, 306 on base, but he wasn't playing much at all either. Ned Yost doesn't really sub in guys that often if he doesn't have to. So Colon wasn't getting a lot of playing time. When I was going back to track down these bold predictions, though, I was listening to the old shows, and you said something like, well, I can see, like, in response to this prediction, you're like, well, I could see it if it's early in the, you know, if the Royals are struggling, they might make a change if Infante's not hitting well. Unless there's something like 20-10 and they just want to roll with it. Well, I went back and looked at their record, and the Royals started 20-11. Infante was not hitting, and they just decided to roll with it. So, you know, there you are. And now I get Infante's kind of hitting okay now. I mean, at least recently. So
yeah, I just pulled it up. He's hitting, you know, 278, 293 on base, which is poor, but you know what you're getting with Infante. And 330 slugging. So, you know, it's not good by any means, but
yeah,
it's not the 191 he was hitting. I was looking at the wrong split. That was the last. Where is it?
Hold on.
I'm sorry. That was the last 28 days. So if we just look at.
Not a ton better, but I guess it's a little.
No. But if you want to look at like June, you know, he hit 239, which, you know, again, is not that great. Well, it's not great. And then, but compared to his May of 207, it starts to look a little bit better.
It's a little better, yeah. So, I think this could still happen, but they're also at a point, if they just keep winning, they have zero reason to make a change. I mean, it's hard to expect them to do any kind of change like that. Yeah. So, this one is pending. I'd lean towards it's probably not going to happen that way, unless Colon just literally starts blistering the ball or Infante gets hurt and is out for an extended amount of time, which it could still happen. I mean, he's got the injury history, so that's pending, probably leaning no on that one.
Yeah, and I've been, you know, kind of pleasantly surprised at the serviceability of his defense at second base. You know, he makes the plays that he should make.
Yeah, other than today.
Other than today, yes. But that was also, Escobar was at fault on that same play. Right. So, you know, he's an all-star. You give him a pass every once in a while for flubbing up. But
yeah, it was uncharacteristic. So
yeah, ultimately, you know, whereas everyone else on the diamond, Moose can make an exceptional play, Hosmer can make an exceptional play, Escobar, you know, Infante, he's not gonna make that exceptional.
And it's second base. It's like he's not needing to all the time.
No.
He doesn't need to make those plays. He just needs to make the plays that he can make, and
yeah,
and he generally does that. So that's okay. And sometimes he makes good plays. So, you know, if he's hitting eighth or ninth, you can live with that.
Yeah, and it might just happen that you were a year early on that prediction. It might be next year.
Maybe.
Cologne unseats him. Or who knows? Maybe, you know, they've experimented with Chester Cuthbert at second base in the minors. And he came up and he, you know, I've been pretty intrigued by Cuthbert so far because, you know, he hasn't been incredibly dominant in the sparse playing time that he's had. But at the same time, you know, he's definitely proved that he belongs.
Yeah, he had a good spring training, and he looked the part when he was filling in for Moustakas last week.
And I mentioned this on Twitter, but I've always kind of, because I've been, back when I was writing for you, Mike, at Kings of Kauffman, when I was doing all the minor league stuff, I've been following Cuthbert basically since he came on the scene.
Yeah.
And so it feels like he's been around forever, and he's still only 22 years old, so he's still got some time to improve, but I've always kind of got the feeling, just from talking to the scouts that I did at the time and ever since, and, you know, hearing what people say about him in the organization, that he's kind of a guy that plays up to his competition. So, you know, his stats may never wow you at any level, but, you know, there can be pretty consistent that once he gets used to it and he gets to the point where he can play, he's going to do that same kind of baseline at every level, which is something to be said for that. But it's a lot harder to tell when the player's ready. It's going to take a situation like Moose having to leave the team for a few days to where, okay, we have to bring him up. We don't have a choice, to really get a feel for it, because it's hard to know with players like that, you know, when they're actually ready.
Yeah, and you kind of see the same thing with Cologne, where it's like, okay, I mean, he did okay in Omaha, and even last year when he was up, he did fine, but, you know, he's not given the opportunity to play all the time, and so it's like, what do you really know about him at this level? And so, I think Cuthbert afforded himself well, and he's kind of intriguing. I mean, to be a 22-year-old and get there and come up and do well. And he left on a high note. They sent him back after he hit like an RBI triple and had a couple of hits and like ran down a foul pop up, and you know, then Moustakas was reactivated. So he went back to Omaha hitting 300 in the big leagues. So it's like, I mean, we'll see him again in September. So
for sure,
if not sooner, if something happens. So I feel comfortable with him. I'm not sure about second because I just don't know, but.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, who knows?
I only brought that up just to say that, you know, it could be another option for the Royals when looking to, if they really want to make that bold move and replace Infante.
Yep. And like, they did try him there, so it seemed like maybe he could do something. So
yeah, who knows? All right, so what's next?
All right, the next one is the I guess it'll be the Kyle Zimmer special. I'm interested to see what it is next year. Which
next pitcher
year,
next
go
year
with.
Will be Miguel Almonte next year.
Maybe, yeah. on this one, the prediction from you is that Sean Manaea will pitch 25 innings in the big leagues.
Wah, wah, wah.
Which he's right now at zero. But he did have some setbacks.
Has he pitched at all, is the question.
Yeah, he's pitched.
Yeah, I know. He's pitched in Arizona.
He's finally kind of come back. He's pitched in Arizona. He's pitched in Wilmington. Yeah, he's finally assigned there. I think they're probably going to be ready to like push him as long as he shows that he's, you know, good at a level and just bump him up. I'm not 100% sure what like their plan is. I don't know. But he is pitching well. I mean, he's got 16 innings pitched in official games. That's two games in Wilmington and one in the Arizona Rookie League. And 19 strikeouts and only one walk. So that's pretty nice. I think they expected him to be in Double A to start the year and for most of the year. So he's kind of playing against lower competition, but he's also dominating them like he should. And so I think haven't seen the plan on him, but I would bet he's probably going to have another couple starts in Wilmington, maybe have three or four with Northwest Arkansas. And you just kind of see from that point. And maybe that means he ends up in the bullpen once rosters expand in September. Maybe there's an injury and he gets called up early if he's really, really throwing well. 25 innings may be tough, though.
Yeah, I'm probably going to chalk that one up to a loss. Not much to say about that. The variability you dabble in when you try and predict prospect innings.
And rookies, and I don't know. I mean, at the time, Ryan Madsen, we weren't really sure that he was going to be such a force. You weren't sure that Morales was going to stick. You weren't sure about, you know, there are a lot of different guys that we didn't, you know, you couldn't count on to have good bullpen appearances. You know, you weren't sure that it was going to happen.
I don't think Finnegan, he didn't have the greatest spring at the time.
And you didn't figure that they would be shuffling him back and forth to be a reliever more. You figured he was going to be stuck in the minors to...
they'd give him that shot to be that starter.
To be the starter, and more or less this year has kind of given up as far as that kind of development, which I don't know what that says long term. I imagine it probably means they just don't think he can do it, or else they would have found another guy to come up and do it.
Yeah.
But there's only so many innings, and if you're a guy who's just making rehab spots, it's going to be tough to crack that. But I also think at the time he hadn't really had the setbacks yet. I think it was like an oblique. I might be wrong on what the injury was, but
he
had something that held him back, and then he was working in simulated games and in rookie leagues and things like that, and then instructional leagues and stuff, just to kind of keep getting the work in, but not ready to get sent out. And at the time we made these bold predictions, that wasn't really like a well-known thing. It wasn't a big thing yet, so
no.
You kind of get a pass because we were going the idea that they were going to be he was going to be on a regular workload from the start of the year.
That's why they call him bold,
right?
Sometimes you got to get out there.
You got to hang it out there.
Make a play, you know. So all right, what's next?
My second one was one, and when I made the comment of it, I said I'm probably going to get burned for this. And I didn't even really believe it that well at the time, but it was that Mike Moustakas would have a 100 or better OPS plus this season. This was in the middle of all of his talk of adjustment and that he was going to be the number two hitter and all of this. I didn't necessarily buy it, but I could kind of see it. I could see how it would work out. Going into today, he was at 114 for his OPS plus. So, I'm not sure what it is after today. He got two hits today. So I would imagine it'll go up a little bit, maybe to 115. I'm not 100% sure what he would have to do to drop it below 100. He just went on a stretch where he was slumping quite a bit before he went on but the family emergency list, which maybe there's a connection there. Maybe not. Maybe it just happens that he was slumping and then the emergency came up. I don't know. But I feel pretty good about that one. I feel like he can hold that.
I think that's your 2 million fan prediction that I think both of us in both those cases are pretty good. We're pretty set.
Feel pretty good about that, yeah.
I've been fully converted. I've seen enough to believe in Mike Moustakas for this year. Not to say that he won't ever go back, but for this year, I think he's got it working. He's in a point where he doesn't have too much pressure to be anything he's not from the team, and he's just cruising. So I'm on board. I'm on board with this.
It's kind of like last year where they had Valencia and they had some guys with the idea that maybe they would push him. This year, he's at a point where he doesn't have to look over his shoulder and can just be comfortable and work on what he needs to work on. Maybe that works for him better than it does to really have like someone breathing down your back like last year. I think that's always kind of interesting, especially for Moustakas, who doesn't always have the reputation of doing all of the stuff you can do to improve, like, you know, video and extra work and things like that.
Right.
So if he's had that conversion where he's actually going to go out and work on it, well, then this is, you know, an appearance is his reward for it. So good for him, you know. Yeah, he's a lot more likable now than he was this time last year. That's for sure.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's like we were talking about earlier in the season that there was all this talk about his adjustments, and had he come out of the gate hitting 140 like he did last year,
yeah,
then he might have just gone back to what he was doing. Mm-hmm. But he came out of the gate smoking and had a great first, you know, quarter of the season. And things kind of tapered off, but he's still hovering around that 300 batting average. Still got a solid 350 on base, at least going into today's game, which both those will probably – they're not going to go any worse. So, I mean, you know, it's – yeah, he's really turned things around, and it's been – that's another thing that's just been – you know, it's been fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, considering that we were ready to pass on him, to actually have him be something, that's pretty cool. So –
absolutely. Yep. Never thought, and you, I think this was your tweet, but Mike Moustakas is an all-star before Eric Hosmer or something.
Yep.
You never thought you'd say.
Never right really would have thought you. It. Even though third base is less of a competition than first, it still doesn't feel right. It still is a little weird.
Yeah.
But, hey, he did it. Good for him. So
absolutely good for him.
Yeah.
Okay, so next, what was my third and final bold prediction?
Your third prediction was about Lorenzo Cain, where you said,
here we go,
that he would finish the year with a better than 300 batting average. So now, after today, he's hitting 316. And he's hit about 500 the last 3 weeks. He's just on fire. Like, he's in full-on MVP cyborg kind of mode right
yeah.
now. He's just a monster.
It was really funny because, and I think I tweeted you a comment about it, but the last, just his, in the last 14 days, I just pulled up his splits on Baseball Reference. In the last 14 days, he's hitting 432, 488, 784.
Yeah.
And in the last week, it's even better, which, you know, it's only three games, but 455, 500, 1091
uh-huh.
in the last three games with two home runs. So
just ridiculous.
There's that. Yeah, it's, but we said it last show where I was like, you know, it just seems like every time Cain or every time the Royals need a big play, Cain has come up, whether it's offensively or defensively. He's not much of a home run hitter, but his home runs always seem to be clutch.
Right.
And God, what was it? It was against the Rays. I'm trying to think, but I can't remember the exact.
He had two homers against the Rays. He had two walk-off game-winning runs against the Twins just on this homestand.
Yeah.
So,
but there was not only those plays, but then there was the home run against one of the home runs against the Rays was like after the Rays had just taken the lead and that either tied it up or took the lead back for the Royals. And I sent you a tweet where I was like, remember what I said on the show?
Yep.
And it was just, I mean, just again and again, he's come up. And I think I sent an email, and you know, we don't have to discuss this too much. We can probably save this a little for Tuesday.
Yeah.
But I mean, is there a legitimate conversation to be had about Lorenzo Cain as AL MVP? Not necessarily, you know, again, not necessarily that he should or should not win, but you know, is there a conversation to be had?
Yeah, I think there is, and I think that's something we can get in depth on Tuesday when we're talking to everybody out at the All-Star Game Watch Party at Kelly's Westport Inn, starting about 6 o'clock. Da, 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 da. Kelly's Westport Inn. I think there is. I mean, you just see what he's carrying the team in a lot of ways right now. He's leads the team in hits. He's tied with Hosmer and Escobar. He's got the second most doubles, second most triples, third most homers, most runs scored, most stolen bases, third in the league in stolen bases. Leads the team in slugging percentage. Just he's doing great. Second in on base percentage behind Gordon. Just incredible. And Gold Glove defense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I mean,
134 OPS plus. I mean, one of the things I like to look at is, you talked about his batting average hitting 316, and when you look at on base percentage. One of the things I like to look at is the difference between on base and batting average, just to see, you know, because a lot of times, like, I think when I was looking at when the Royals signed Omar Infante, I think one year with the Tigers, he had like a 310 batting average, but his on base was like 318 or 330 or something.
Right.
It's just like, so you're talking like five walks or something throughout the course of a year,
yeah,
you know?
Basically.
And I like to shoot for about 50 points of difference. If you're about 50 points higher on your on base, then you're going to be in pretty good shape, I think. And Kane has, he's held serve with that pretty much all season. You know, he's been, he's had not only the good batting average, but you know, he's had good plate appearances and he's had good at bats and he's getting on base, you know, not only just with putting the ball in the field, but drawing some good walks, and he's hitting for power and, you know, not a ton of home runs, but 18 doubles, like you said, and he's stealing bases. I mean, he's just like, he's a five tool player, right?
Yeah. Now. He's doing everything at the moment. And it's pretty awesome to like go from a point where, you're just not sure on what he was going to be, and then to like see him bust out like this, that's pretty, you know, he's a good guy too. So, and well deserving of the start in the All-Star game. So
absolutely. Cause I mean, if you look at his last 365 days, right, which is 139 games, which, you know, for his career has been actually
a whole season,
close to a whole season, just cause he misses some time, whatever. But you know, he's at a 304 batting average with 354 on base, 447 slugging, so you know, over 800 on the OPS, and an OPS plus of 128 with 10 home runs. You know, I mean, and that's 10 home runs was because he had, you know, some power struggles last year, and a lot of those have happened this season. So I mean, he's just such a fun player to watch because, like you said, such a great guy, so deserving of all the accolades that he's gotten. And he's just like, he plays just like Alex Gordon. He plays so hard and so well. But unlike Alex Gordon, who Alex Gordon's a little bit more reserved and everything, nothing wrong with that, you know, but he's just a more reserved guy, and that's fine. But, you know, Kane is, he's making the clubhouse videos with Sal Perez on Instagram, and he's out there, you know, doing with all the Gatorade dumping and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, he's just like, he's a really marketable guy. And if Major League Baseball and the Royals are smart, they're going to start putting him front and center with a lot of marketing stuff. Sal Perez, Eric Hosmer, and Lorenzo Cain are the three most marketable guys this team has. And Cain's the one that's kind of gotten left behind a little bit. I think a little bit is the kind of the wait and see approach.
Yeah.
Last year was just a fluke or not, but I think it's enough now that, you know, he can be a really marketable guy.
I remember back in like 20, this is early 2011. One of the first like real big like interviews I ever had with anybody in the baseball industry was with Josh Kuznick, who is Lorenzo Cain's agent. And one of the things that I recall from that was that he was talking about, you know, this is a month after the Greinke trade that brought Cain and Escobar and Jeremy Jeffress and Jake Odorizzi to Kansas City. And he was telling me about Cain, and he was like, this guy's going to work hard. He's going to make highlight plays. He's going to hit the ball. People are going to love Lorenzo Cain. You're going to see his shirt all over Kansas City one day. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, here's
agent
the thing.
Speak.
Yeah, he's like, it's 25-year-old center fielder who's got 10 games in the mail. I'm not 100% sure on this. Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm excited about him, but and it took a couple years. Gov, you know, he was injured here and there. 2012, tore the groin muscle. 2011, basically sat because Melky Cabrera was on fire.
2013, he had
some injuries. Last year, finally kind of had something. But even going into this year, a lot of the idea was like, well, his BABIP was really high. Well, yeah, and that's kind of why your prediction was 300, because that was a question mark. Can he do that again? Because there's skepticism anytime someone hits that well and their BABIP is really high. So I there were still the question marks, even going into this year, but he's really answering them. And even, you know, throwing some power into the mix, which is kind of an unexpected benefit. You didn't really think that he was going to do that. Which brings me to the final prediction, which was mine, that he was going to hit 15 homers this year, which, I wasn't really sure I believed it. He's at 8 now. he's got a shot at that. And I think if the gains that he's made are for real, he's going to beat that, which makes him just that much more valuable. You know, as we've talked about, his slugging's right up there. I mean, you've got a guy like Perez who's got 15 homers, who's like basically a 30 home run pace almost. Morales hit his 11th today. Gordon had 11 before he got hurt. So you've got some guys with power, but Lorenzo Cain still leads the team in slugging percentage. So he's got the doubles power, the triples power. He's got, you know, had a double today, a couple homers over the homestand.
Yeah, and that's
just
what...
it rounds him out so much that it just makes him like a real breakout kind of guy. It's almost a shame that he's like 29 now, and you know, because it does seem like he's a lot younger. But yeah, it's also, you know, he started so late too that there was a lot of development that had happened before he got to this point.
Yeah, and it's lost my train of thought for a second. But as we're talking about Lorenzo Cain's power, Mike, why don't you go ahead and give what your third and final bold prediction was?
Oh, that was it. The Lorenzo Cain was going to hit 15.
There it is.
Which is, he's got a shot. And if it trends this way, I mean, I think he's got a good shot at it. And if he doesn't, shoot, if he gets you 10 homers, you're still looking pretty good. So I feel pretty good about that prediction. Yeah, I mean, I feel all right about that. I think yeah, just Cain himself is just such a dynamic guy that if he does add that power element, it makes him a really special player. And I don't know that you really expected that out of him at all. I thought solid, great defense, speed, but you know, not really the run production. Like coming into the year, he wasn't the prototypical number three guy, and now he's a little more of that role. And I think that's really big for the Royals lineup.
Yeah, and you know, we'll get into this a little bit more on the All-Star game discussion. But I mean, if he basically has the line he has now and ticks up the power just a notch or two, and ends the season with 20 home runs and 85-90 RBIs in that 315, 370, 480 slash line mold with Gold Glove defense, I mean, that's where you really start to get into the MVP discussion. And again, we'll talk more about that on Tuesday. But man, that's a hell of a season if he can pull that off. And yeah, his sights are set on it right now. And it's you don't look at that and think that it's wishful thinking. You know, you look at it and say, you know, that's totally something that can absolutely happen. And he's demonstrated enough consistency over the last year and a half that it's something that it could be for real.
Yeah, that's super exciting, and it does put him right there in that kind of spot of like the big faces of this team. I mean, Sal Perez is the social media darling, and Hosmer's always kind of the go-to guy, but Cain's just he's a charismatic guy. He's perfect guy for that role. So he's the kind of guy for that role that Alex Gordon never really wanted to be, which, again, not any knock against Gordon. It's just not his personality, but Cain would relish it, I think. And, you know, I think the Royals would have something there.
Yeah. And, you know, let's see here. I'm trying to pull up, like, I look at Lorenzo Cain from a statistical standpoint. They're kind of different players, but just statistically speaking, you know, I see some Andrew McCutchen similarities. And what year did McCutchen win he won the MVP, right? Was that
it was 20
was that,
was that or last year? I don't remember. No, Kershaw was last year.
Yeah.
And McCutchen was the year before.
2013. So his 2013, I mean, he hit 317, 404, 508, 21 home runs.
Huh.
You know, so I mean,
yeah,
Kane's not trending exactly to that.
Just below that.
Just short of that.
Yeah.
But his defense is better. McCutchen's got, and that's, you know, McCutchen's got really good defense, but that's just how good Lorenzo Cain is. So, and defensively speaking. So, you know, I mean, just for a baseline there, and obviously, you know, National League, you know, things are a little bit different, I guess, but offensively speaking, they shouldn't be that different. So, you know, usually the advantage comes in with the pitching. But, so that's kind of an interesting little comparison there.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought to have looked at that. The easy one is always like Torii Hunter, and look at peak Torii Hunter, because they're
right.
A lot like that's what Kane that, always modeled his game after was Torii Hunter.
And they even had a point in the game today where they showed a clip of Torrey Hunter hitting a home run,
mm-hmm.
and then one of Lorenzo Cain,
and it's the same
the similarities in the swing, which I had never really noticed it, but my word, it was
it's the same. Even the lean back is the same.
Yeah, I mean they kind of drew a line to show kind of the center of gravity, if you will, of each player, and it was the same shape, and their foot placement was the same, and everything. It's crazy. I mean, the only thing that I noticed in the knock on Kane was always the bat speed, the getting his hands through the zone fast enough, and you could even tell on the slow motion replay that Torrey Hunter had a little bit quicker bat, but mm-hmm. that's the only real difference you could notice, and that's only if you're looking like I was. So, you know, as much as Torrey Hunter seems like he kind of sucks as a person, based on some of the comments that he's made, as a player on the field, if that's what he ends up being, you know, for the next 5 to 7 years for the Royals, then fan-effing-tastic.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it'll all just be like a matter of his health. If he can hold up,
yep.
if his legs can hold up, then yeah. And I think that's probably the only reason they haven't done any kind of an extension is just because you're not 100% sure on a yeah. guy with his injury history.
And I think they've done a good job of managing that this year and giving him the appropriate amount of days off and things. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it, too, is now kind of like how you were talking, Moustakas doesn't have to look over his shoulder anymore. Well, Kane doesn't have to look over his shoulder anymore. He showed last year that he can be healthy. He showed last year how good he really is. So they know now that if Kane's healthy, they want him in there. So he doesn't have to look over his shoulder. He doesn't have to worry about that anymore. So now I think they've probably reached a point where he can go into the clubhouse and say, you know what, my leg's feeling a little sore today. Mm-hmm. If you just let me sit, you know, just a day and a half, I should be good to go. Just feeling a little tight, something like that. You know, whereas before, in 2012, 2013, he might have said, I can't say anything because I don't want them to sit me and then I never end up playing again.
Right.
You know, because there are players that happens to. So, you know, I can understand that fear if you're a young player who's never really had an opportunity. But now I think there's a comfort level, and, you know, not to say I don't have any inside information that's what's happening, but I certainly think that it could be pretty realistic in that, you know, Ned's always a guy that's been kind of straightforward, where if you level with him, I don't, you know, he's loyal to his guys. So
it's true. Yeah. So
I hope, you know, I hope that's the case. And then the only thing I wish is that they would kind of transport that to Salvador Perez. But I think you need a different approach with Perez because, you know, Perez could be like the Black Knight in Monty Python. You know, he's lost his arm and he's like, it's okay, coach.
It's okay.
I can catch.
I just get the feeling that they post a lineup with Perez with a day off and he just goes up and like changes
it. Tears it apart.
Like, says, coach, no. Coach, your lineup card's gone.
Yeah.
Ned, your lineup's gone. You need a new one.
Yes.
And just does that all afternoon until he finally puts him back in.
I could totally see that happening, actually.
No. Or just scratches Butera's name out and puts his name. Like, no, yeah.
With a smiley face.
I am the catcher. I am the catcher now.
I'm the catcher. I could totally see that.
So, I love Perez.
The different tact would just have to be, Ned would just be like, hey, listen, you're just going to sit.
You're just going to sit.
So
you get the day off.
Yes. I've often wondered, and this is kind of an aside, but I've often wondered if the Royals, there's all this kind of background talk of Perez wanting the Royals to redo his deal, and rightfully so, because he's already outperformed it, and right. The Royals got a hell of a deal. He took a risk that he would outperform the deal and that he'd be in this position, but, you know, the Royals also took a risk in mm-hmm. that, you know, they'd seen 40 games of a player that had only seen a week in AAA, and they took a gamble on him. So there was risk both ways. It paid off for the Royals, didn't necessarily pay off for Perez, even though he did get a large sum of money.
Yeah.
But I've often kind of wondered if maybe the Royals are like, we know we got a steal here, so we'll just let him play as much as he wants.
Ride it out.
Around, whatever, and then he can't get out of this contract. I don't think I've ever remembered in my life a baseball player that's held out, not like in football. Yeah. So, you know, they'll be like, he'll play, and he might be unhappy, but he'll play, and we'll get our money's worth, and then, you know, by the time we actually lose him, it's not going to matter because he'll be past his prime. You know, I mean, that's a horrible way to think of it. And yeah. You feel bad even thinking of it that way. But the business side does kick in at some point when you're looking, dealing with these contracts. And, you know, right now I got the Royals have all the leverage in that scenario. So
they do.
That's a different topic for a different day. But
mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, on that note, they don't have any incentive to make a change on it.
No.
I see a lot of times on that topic where people are like, well, they're exploiting. I'm like, well, here's the thing. He signed for like $25,000 when he was 16, which, okay, maybe the system is completely exploited. You know, it's not a great system in some of those cases where you get some of those guys who have some potential, but you sign them for hardly anything and whatever. Whereas other guys might get $2 million on a signing bonus or whatever. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's like when he signed that deal, the scouting reports were like, yeah, we think he can do this, but we're not 100% sure he's ever going to really hit that great.
Yeah.
He's going to definitely be good defensively, but he's also a big catcher, and big catchers don't have a history of holding up that well. And again, he'd only had less than 2 months in the big leagues. And so for them to jump out and give him that money up front, well, compared to what he made earlier, that $25,000 signing bonus plus just being in the minors, well, now he gets this opportunity where he gets like $1 million up front. It's like that's a pretty good deal when, you know, you're still kind of not living that high. So, I, you know, at that point, and they're doing that to a guy who hardly had any experience, who was not really a – I mean, he was like a top 20 prospect, but he – it's not like he was their number two guy for a couple of years.
No.
So they took a chance on it. They saw what they needed to see and really, really liked them. But, you know, it wasn't like it was a slam dunk. There were still questions about how good of a deal it was going to be. And then it just was apparent after that first year, or at least more like into the second, because he got hurt right after he signed that too.
Yeah.
Which is another thing.
The meniscus tear.
Yeah, the meniscus tear. Thank you, Jonathan Sanchez, once again. But at that point, it was like, okay, yeah, I mean, there's still some risk to this guy. And I think once you got through that season and once you got through 2013 especially, it was like, okay, yeah, they got a really good deal. But the ink's signed. The deal's done. It's like there's nothing you can do. There's no push to actually change it. It's going to be a matter of the Royals deciding they want to extend him beyond what rights they have to him, which is through 2019, which I wouldn't even think that's going to come up until, you know, maybe a couple of years from now. So
and I absolutely think the Royals will redo the deal.
Yeah.
I think it'll be somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, maybe after this season, do it for 5 years from now for $50 million or something like that. You know, I mean, I think something like that, and that's still under what he's worth.
Yeah.
Ultimately, but again, they have all the leverage.
Yep. Yep. And that's just, you know, there's a lot of spots where the players union has a lot of the advantage, but there's also a lot of spots where, you know, it's contract and nothing to make them change it.
Yeah. And if anything, you know, the blame shouldn't be on the Royals or Sal Perez so much as it should be on his agent, who somehow
he's replaced since then. Yeah.
So,
okay, you can kind of see why.
Yeah, and you know, and that's what, you know, Scott Boras, as much as he gets a lot of crap, you know, that's why he waits and doesn't advise his clients, and rarely do you see his clients sign like that. Because you get into scenarios like this, you know, and had Sal Perez just waited out those first couple of years and not taken the money, then
right now they'd be talking to him, trying to work out some kind of deal, and he'd probably be getting more.
Yeah, he'd be making more from arbitration. Because, I mean, you look at Eric Hosmer, because I went back and looked at their salaries, and in 2012 and 2013, Hosmer was making a little over $500K each year. And Perez was making $750 in 2012 and made $1 million in 2013. So he was making, you know, a good chunk more than Eric Hosmer in those couple of years. But now Hosmer's hit arbitration, so he's making $5 million this year, and Perez is making $1.75 million. So, you know, and it's one of those things that happens. It'll be a real interesting off-season discussion. So we'll kind of table it until then. But So that kind of sums it up, Mike. Those are our bold predictions so far. Yeah. We did a lot of the over-under stuff, if that's what you're if that's what some of you listeners are thinking of. And we're actually going to go over all the over-unders that we had and see what our status is, where we are on those on Tuesday at the All-Star game. So, or I should say at Kelly's Westport Inn, where we're watching the All-Star game.
Yep.
So show up there and you can boo us and tell us how stupid we are, or praise us and tell us how smart we are. Whichever you deem worthy, at Kelly's on Tuesday night.
Please don't heckle us.
Yes, please. I don't know how to handle doing a podcast while being heckled. So actually I did. We did a podcast with Kamler for like 2 years. So, right. so I guess that's untrue. I know how to deal with many a distraction whilst podcasting.
Yep.
Regardless, you should come out to Kelly's. It's going to be an awesome time.
We're going to give away some stuff. I've got a Frank White book that is autographed that I'm going to give away. I've got a copy of Willie Mays Aiken's book that I'll give away. Kamler is going to give away one or two of his books if you're interested, I guess. I don't know.
If you need some kindling. Only a joke. Only a joke.
I've got a couple Kelly's gift certificates I may give away too. So we want to see people out there. So tell your friends. Everybody's invited as long as you're 21 and older.
Yes.
You don't have to be a Royals fan, but it's if you found this podcast, I don't know how else you wouldn't. You know,
yes.
I don't think a Reds fan is probably seeking us out, but you never know.
But if you're a Reds fan, you live in Kansas City. Show up anyway.
Yeah, tell us how that happened.
Unless you're a Cardinals or a Twins fan, opposing team fans are always welcome.
Right, pretty much. Yeah, that's generally
even
the
way if you're a Cardinals or a Twins fan, as long as you're a good person and you're not like some of the trash we've seen on Twitter making awful comments about Mike Moustakas' situation. But that is also another topic for another time.
Right.
But yeah, everyone who, if you're listening to this podcast, absolutely come on out. Kelly's Westport Inn. Tuesday night, starting at 6. Going to be an awesome time. Mike will be there. Myself will be there. Many other fun Royals fans. It'll be fun. It's always fun when we have these get-togethers. So come on out.
Yep. Want to see you out there.
All right. So with that, we're going to end this show. And we will pick it back up on Tuesday night where the Royals will have, we'll call it 6.5 All-Stars. I'm not sure if Gordon's actually going to be there, even though he's injured. Probably not.
No, he's going to stay KC.
They already said, okay.
Yep.
Yeah, so 6 All-Stars there, but 7 total. So we're gonna cheer them on. We're going to drink some beers. It's going to be fun. Come on out. Kelly's Westport Inn on Tuesday night. For Michael Engel, I am Jeff Herr. This has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault. Thanks for stopping by, and as always, go Royals.